Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, a chief executive officer's pay surges while profits fall. Is corporate South Africa rewarding failure? South Africa's water resilience now hinges on maintenance, not mega projects, says one expert. Africa hits $205 billion in crypto transactions, with cyber criminals closing in fast. And a digital revolution lands in the ring as a tech leader transforms boxing promoter Golden Gloves. It's Wednesday, the 26th of November. Now, African Bank is under pressure after reportedly awarding its chief executive officer a 64% pay increase in the same year that the bank reports a major profit slump. The decision, I think, has sparked broader questions about executive remuneration and accountability. And someone that watches this trend line very closely is Tracy Davies, executive director at Just Share. Tracy, maybe just the opening point, how do you interpret the timing of a 64% pay increase alongside a significant profit slump? What's your reading?
Hi, Jeremy. You know, it actually becomes, it is becoming increasingly difficult to make any sense of these payouts, whether from a timing point of view or otherwise. You'll see that the, as you would have seen from the article that discusses this on News 24, the African Bank CEO says that these, a lot of the bonuses involved here are actually due to previous periods. And so you can't compare his current executive pay with the current profitability or otherwise of the bank. But I think, you know, we get caught up in the particular numbers or the particular timing of one executive, but we really need to zoom out and look at the whole picture. And the whole picture is that these numbers are just obscene by any measure, and regardless of what they are or are not linked to, which is very unclear. And, you know, we have this roundabout conversation in South Africa about executive pay, but we never make any progress. And it is just completely, if you look at African Bank has 6.3 million customers, 59 million Rand CEO payout. Standard Bank has 19 million customers, CEO remuneration, 89 million. Discovery Bank has 1.2 million customers, CEO remuneration, 61 million rand. There is just no rational connection here between any metric that will allow us to properly analyze these numbers.
On the broader corporate canvas, whether it's banking or other sectors, do you think that organizations are becoming increasingly disconnected from the economic reality of their customers and their workforce?
100%, absolutely no question about it. The CEO remuneration world is an entirely separate, siloed world that exists outside reality. And I mean, if you look at the listed companies in South Africa, you know, every year at their AGMs, they have to put a say on pay vote for their shareholders to vote on, where shareholders either approve or don't approve the remuneration policies and implementation reports. The numbers of shareholders voting against those policies and implementation reports has dramatically increased over the years. But it doesn't change anything. Every year we see more and more bigger and bigger numbers. There's just no connection whatsoever between the economic reality of the country and of the workers and of what these people are earning.
How do you respond to the argument that talent retention requires higher pay? It's difficult, is it not, to test the validity of any claim in a small, highly competitive market where unique skills are needed?
Yeah, you know, that is a catch-all excuse for all sorts of crazy remuneration practices. Of course, you need to retain talent. But why does Fanie Titi, who's the CEO of Investec, need to be retained with 100 million rand, but Jason Quinn at Nedbank only needs to be retained with 27 million rand? How do you explain that 70 million rand differential in terms of talent retention? There is nothing to suggest that there are any, as I keep saying, that there's any rational basis for these numbers. I mean, you know, it's just kind of staggering. Who, you know, these, and we talk about these annually, you know, this is 61 million rand this year, etc. But this is, these, most of these people have been earning these figures for 5, 10, 15 years. They are worth billions of rands, you know, and are they really contributing to the economy? Are they really the most important people in our society? And the only way that we can retain them and the only way that we can get this talent at the top of these entities is by paying them these extraordinary numbers. There are plenty of people who do extraordinary work in this country for tiny amounts of pay, you know? So it's an excuse. The talent retention thing is an excuse.
It's possible, of course, that boards of directors see value creation differently from how analysts and the public measure it, though.
It is, but boards of directors are supposed to look at these things from a society-wide perspective. You know, listed companies are entities in our society. They don't operate separately. They're not special beings. They have an impact on society. They interact with society. And so the role of a board of directors, the role of a remuneration committee, is to look not just at the value that a particular individual is creating for a company or, you know, for shareholders, but at that in the context of our broader society. And, you know, these numbers also bear, if you look at all the studies that have been done on executive remuneration, there's no correlation between company performance and executive pay. You know, shares go up and down for all sorts of reasons that have nothing to do with the CEO, but they take all the upside when the share price increases and none of the downside when the share price decreases. And there's a whole world of remuneration consultants. And, you know, remember that the boards of directors who are setting these figures and these numbers are also themselves hugely and highly remunerated. It's not in anyone's interests to reduce these numbers. And so, you know, unless there is a binding shareholder vote on pay or some kind of public revolt against these numbers, this is a conversation you and I will be having again this time next year.
So what's the solution? Is it stricter regulation of executive pay, if at all that's possible?
Well, of course, the, you know, industry will fight tooth and nail against that. The chances of that ever happening are very slim, especially because of the revolving door between government and corporate boards of directors, where, you know, you'll find many, many, many ex-government players now earning 5, 10, 15 million rand sitting on the boards of listed companies. So it's not in any of those elite interests to regulate executive pay. But when there are amendments to the Companies Act that will make shareholder votes binding, shareholder votes and executive pay binding, they should be coming into effect any moment. And then, you know, that's the only way that we're going to see any change when you actually give the people who own these companies, shareholders, a proper say in whether these kinds of numbers are acceptable.
But it would seem to me that there's a lot of shareholder apathy in that respect.
Well, there's actually a lot of shareholder risk pushback against executive pay, as I was saying, in relation to the say on pay votes, but those votes are non-binding. So it doesn't matter at the moment how many shareholders object to the remuneration. Companies continue to do what they want. But you're right, there is shareholder apathy because if there really was an appetite to do something about this, shareholders could vote off the chairs of remuneration committees at these companies. You know, there are definitely stronger steps that could be taken. But again, remember that the shareholders, the asset managers who hold shares in these companies, many of them are themselves listed companies with CEOs and other executives earning tens of millions of rands a year. It is a rigged system, Jeremy. There is absolutely no question about it.
Tracy Davies, thank you very much indeed. Executive Director at Just Share.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
South Africa's water security crisis is deepening by all accounts, and experts are warning that the problem isn't a lack of mega projects necessarily, but a failure to maintain the infrastructure we already have. Consulting engineer firm Atana's climate resilience lead, Karen King, says the country is sitting on aging, badly run systems, growing climate risks, and billions lost to weak governance. So How bad is the problem and what needs to be done? Well, Karen, a very warm welcome to you. You say the real crisis is neglected infrastructure, not new projects. Are we close then, in your opinion, to some degree of systemic failure?
Yes, we absolutely are. Our water infrastructure crisis is extremely serious and it's systemic. Most of our wastewater treatment plants discharge inadequately treated sewage into our rivers. Our water leaks and theft are absolutely rife. Financial allocations for water infrastructure fall far short of what's required, and we use an unsustainably high volume of water for such a dry country. And this crisis can then result in severe environmental degradation, extreme public health risks, and even jeopardize our economic stability through failures in agriculture, industry, and lowered investor confidence. So it's really a very serious crisis.
We can talk about solutions in just a moment, but how much, in your opinion, of the water insecurity problem that we have in this country is due to incompetence and bad management rather than just money?
Oh, I think a lot of it, absolutely. I mean, municipalities are spending 2% of their budgets on maintenance instead of a recommended 8%. We lack skilled professionals in all levels, especially key positions in government. So our infrastructure is operating without adequate maintenance and without proper asset management plans. Further to this, there are major accountability gaps at municipal level. There's ongoing political interference, which leads to things like diversion of water service funds. Plus, there's been extreme underinvestment in infrastructure renewal. So yeah, lots of accountability and lots of incompetence problems.
Which I guess raises the question about whether municipalities are even capable of maintaining infrastructure at the standard that is currently required in order just to arrest the problem.
Yeah, I mean, they're not at the moment, and we're going to have to address this on multiple fronts. Because over and above this, urbanization, which is increasingly an effect of climate change when people have to move into cities, is putting additional strain on existing, often already undercapacitated systems. So what we're not getting right now is only going to get worse. Climate change has also led to increased rainfall variability, and our current wastewater systems weren't designed for this variability. So people don't even have a handle on our current systems, let alone what's coming.
So, Karen, the issues that you're raising are not necessarily new, but I'm sure you've applied your mind to where we start the fix, if in fact we can. Is there a starting point?
Yes, there is. So at a municipal level, we need meaningful results delivered in order to restore public trust. This is going to include transparent financial decisions, visible corrective action, and these are essential because frustration stems from both evident corruption and this incompetence. Municipalities are going to need to address not just governance and service delivery, but also community engagement. And this is going to include making things like water quality and wastewater compliance and maintenance schedules publicly accessible. And things like audit results and evidence of this so-called corrective action are also going to have to be publicly available. We also speak about unsuitably qualified people, and we're going to need these to be hired into key positions, but also retained there for long enough to not just put plans in place, but also to see them through. And it's been this quick turnover of people in key positions that's led to a very reactive focus on things like repairs, and really we need a long-term focus on things like planned maintenance.
Let me circle back to the community quotient as far as this is concerned. Yeah. You emphasize community-driven resilience. What does that actually mean or look like beyond a mere slogan?
Well, communities there are a number of things that they can put in place themselves, but really this needs to be put in place in conjunction with the municipalities. For example, a key element of getting things right where I've seen them work are when solutions are co-designed with the local users, making them appropriate. So one of the examples I think that everyone will be familiar with was Cape Town's Day Zero response. Mm. And this worked not just because of strict water demand management, but also because of really effective public engagement, which led to broad behavioral changes. There are also things like wastewater treatment work upgrades and desalination projects in coastal cities, which have benefited from successful private partnerships, which doesn't always happen. And then there needs to be more focus as well on nature-based solutions in conjunction with communities who really understand their environment, their socioeconomic environments, cultural environments, physical environments. And these can often be more effective than green or grey only solutions. We really need to look at these hybrid solutions. There was a low-cost housing project I worked on earlier this year, in which through working with community-based initiatives, we managed to successfully reduce community vulnerability, both flooding and drought. So it really does work.
So how do we better plan for climate risk without just reacting to disasters after they hit what seems to be the modus operandi that we adopt?
Well, I mean, at the municipal level, it'll be all those things I've mentioned previously, transparent final financial decisions, visible corrective action, maintenance, etc. But at an actual community level, there are things that can be done for an ordinary South African household, for example. But this resilience requires being simultaneously prepared for water scarcity and for infrastructure failures and for extreme weather, which could be droughts and floods. So it's really quite a big ask. So things that could be done would be including installing a simple rainwater harvesting system, reusing grey water, investing in simple water backup systems, reducing consumption, checking for leaks. If you must have a garden, make it water wise and permeable. And for those who can afford it, solar power, battery storage systems. And I mean, a lot of this we've heard before, but really at a household level, these kind of things do work. And then more and more flood damage insurance is becoming something that people need.
Just a quick one. Don't we need to be a little bit more creative? Thoughts that I've heard, for instance, making rooftop rainwater harvesting mandatory, for instance, or there's another program about a cash for leaks program that turns residents into paid leak hunters. I'm not saying that those are two ideas that would work, but don't we need to think a little bit more progressively than just the way we're doing right now?
We do, and what would really help that would be more of an enabling environment. So we could see with our power crisis, there was more of an enabling environment coming to the fore where people could put, you know, there was talk about putting power back into the grid, and there was mandatory new builds needed to have solar power and that sort of thing. So yes, something like that would definitely be beneficial. We can also learn from other countries who are grappling with similar problems. So for example, I'm in Nairobi for a climate conference currently, and it's becoming very evident we could learn a lot from Namibia, for example. So they have actively moved away from an over-reliance on maize, which is something we have as well, to more drought-resilient crops such as sorghum and millet, you know, which are also far more pest-resistant and actually far better for you. So we need, I think, to accept that we can learn a lot, and then we also need to make these sorts of things mandatory. This isn't something that we can solve at a household level.
Karen King, thank you very much indeed. I appreciate your time.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, cryptocurrency in Africa has really exploded. Just listen to this number, $205 billion on chain or in-chain transactions in a single year. And that makes the continent one of the world's fastest growing crypto markets. But, and here's the rub, the caveat, with that growth comes a surge in fraud, hacking and illicit transfers. And I want to get into a little bit more depth on this. I'm in conversation with Alan Juma, who's a cybersecurity engineer at ESET. It's a global cybersecurity company known for using AI-driven technology to detect and prevent emerging threats. Alan, a very warm welcome to you. As I've just said, Africa's crypto market is booming, but so is crypto-related crime. From your perspective, what's the single biggest vulnerability then that attackers are exploiting right now?
Thank you very much for having me. I would say one of the biggest vulnerability that we are facing right now is that we have a very young population in Africa. I mean, that's why there's a boom in cryptocurrency. And this leads to a lot of online use and also mobile use. And unfortunately, majority of the young people are a bit casual or lax about their cybersecurity, be it in crypto or any other way. So you'll find that many mobile devices actually do not have PIN codes. Many wallet accounts, though they they actually the crypto accounts, they actually force you to create two-factor authentication, but you'll find some of the passwords may not be secure. Basically, overall cyber hygiene is one of the biggest challenge. Yes, I know they're advanced level attacks, but the main or the primary problem is poor user hygiene when it comes to digital devices.
Alan, regulators we know are tightening anti-money laundering rules. Is that working without enough robust cybersecurity? Are there practical gaps that governments keep missing, do you think?
I would say yes. I mean, and the fact would be, do you know in Africa there's only one country that has actually legislated or they have actually legalized crypto assets, cryptocurrency, and that's South Africa, with Kenya quite on its heels trying to regularize it. So you can see out of the many countries in Africa, only two are actually making efforts towards legalizing and putting in measures to reduce the fraud and the money laundering that can be associated with cryptocurrency. So I would say one of the issues we are facing as African, as a continent and as African countries is we fear it too much. Rather than come up with laws that will actually help, we are hell-bent on responding with hammers and saying we're banning all sorts of cryptocurrencies because maybe they might compete with our fiat and our stable coins. And this fear is leading to a lot of black market exchanges, and that leads to the thriving of fraud and money laundering.
In fact, you say that Africa has become a testing ground for financial cybersecurity. Is that because criminals just see the continent, as I think you're saying, as an easy target?
Unfortunately, it is true. Because of our weak legislation, because of our young population and also lack of regulations, we are finding that majority of the international hackers are trying to test out their methods and their methodologies and their hacks in Africa. Call it a low-hanging fruit, whereby you can test it in Africa. If it works, then you know for sure it can work in another continent. You find tweak it. If it does not work, they know for sure it's not ready for the more advanced continents or the more advanced market, which is unfortunate, but that is where we find ourselves right now.
Alan, it's all very well to identify the problem as you've done, but many African countries, I would suggest, lack the technical capacity to secure crypto platforms. Why is that? And do you think that this maybe should become more of a national security priority rather than just a financial regulation issue?
Yeah, I agree with you. It should become a national policy because whether we like it or not, crypto is here to stay. So rather than fighting, rather than spreading fear, there needs to be a stronger collaboration between banks, telcos, and crypto firms, as well as government, because we use a lot of mobile money in our African continent. So this will allow innovation and also will encourage interoperability between regulated entities, that is the banks and the crypto firms. And this will, with government in place leading this legislation, it will give it the legality. And once it has been given the legality, you'll bring experts on board who will come up with policies or will come with regulations that are actually practical. They can be practically implemented in all our societies. Of course, we also need to do a lot of user awareness and user training on the dangers of cryptocurrency. Not all the dangers of cryptocurrency, but the dangers that can become associated with cryptocurrency because of the widespread of it in Africa and also the cyber attacks.
But there's a difficult contradiction here. We know that millions of Africans rely on crypto because traditional banking excludes them. It's difficult, is it not, to secure digital finance without blocking access for the very people who need it?
Yeah, it's a conundrum, if I may say so. Mm. But I'll give you an example. I don't know how familiar you are with mobile money transfer.
Enlighten me.
Okay, so basically in majority of a number of the African countries, Kenya, Nigeria, Tanzania, Rwanda, there's what we call mobile money transfer, where we can send money from our mobile devices. You can think of it just as a mobile wallet. And this has gone to rural areas that are not served by major banks. And you can see that such mobile money transfers are actually powering the economies. And when you actually partner it with cryptocurrencies, this will help the penetration even into the deeper area, because mobile money transfer can be used even by the oldest or even people who have not gone to school because of the simplicity. And this has been aided by the adoption by government and the serious partnership between private sector and government sector to make it some sort of the way to reach the unreached areas. If the same is replicated in cryptocurrencies, then we'll definitely see even a bigger boom in the numbers of cryptocurrency users in our continent.
Regulation is one thing, but how difficult is enforcement and prosecution? What have you discerned in that respect?
I mean, true, we can come up with a policy, we can sit down a round table, come up with a policy, but having it been enforced, that's a challenge. How do you enforce it? You make sure that you have the right people in the right places. Unfortunately, in Africa, some of these jobs are given to cronies, are given to, you know, for political purposes. So you'll find that technocrats or people who understand these particular policies are not there to ensure that it is actually put into place. And if we may, we can have a plan, but if we don't have a strategy to put it on the ground and to implement it on the ground, that will be the challenge. As far as enforcement is concerned, we need to have cross-border collaboration. Kenya should be working with South Africa. South Africa should be working with Egypt in order to decentralize our borders as far as cybersecurity and cryptocurrency is concerned. Because I will commit a crime in South Africa and maybe I'm based in Egypt. Which law will prosecute me? Where I committed the crime or the country I'm resident in? But we have, when we have cross-border laws that can actually aid in when it comes to, you know, interdiction and extradition, this can help operationalize and actually implement these policies.
Alan Juma, thank you very much indeed. Cyber security engineer at ESET. I appreciate your time.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now let's move on to this, and Golden Gloves, Africa's biggest and oldest boxing promoter, is stepping into a new era after 50 years, bringing in South African tech entrepreneur Nivi Grogel to lead a full-scale digital transformation. This is really interesting. It's a major shift for a sport that is built, I think, on legacy, loyalty and tradition, but it does raise questions about how boxing in South Africa is going to be run in the future, watched and monetized. So Nivi is the founder of the digital firm IME and now architect, I guess, of Golden Gloves' new digital strategy. Nivi, a very warm welcome to you. As I said at the beginning of this conversation, the organization has survived for half a century without any heavy digital integration. What's convinced everyone that now is the moment to disrupt that model, which has obviously been working?
Yeah, thanks, Jeremy. You're right. It's been around, I think, 48 years to be exact. But I think there definitely needed to be a shift. I think a mindset shift, because how people watch sport today has completely changed. I think actually just how we actually consume content in general has changed. So people are always on their phones. They're on streaming platforms. They expect the access, the highlights and the stories on demand. So if we don't modernize now, we actually risk losing the next generation of boxing fans. So it's almost a point of like, you know, we have to adapt or die. And we have the history, like you've mentioned, we've got the fighters, and now we've got the digital tools to, and the partnerships to take African boxing to a much bigger audience.
The next generation is critical. That new audience, I understand, is vital if the sport is going to make money. But you're introducing tech into a sport that, as I mentioned, is rooted in old school promotion, relationships, tradition. It's going to be difficult, surely, to modernize without alienating the core boxing community, which I would suggest to you still remains important.
No, definitely important, but I think the boxing community as a whole is looking for a change. There's something that needs to be done differently. If we look overseas, we're looking at other digital platforms like DAZN Boxing, that becomes like the home of boxing. If you look at like what the other promoters are doing overseas, they're partnering with like DAZNs and things like that for the live streaming, the pay-per-views. So basically what we're doing right now is putting a digital backbone in place for boxing. You know, like the live streaming, the video on demand and the pay-per-view. So whilst, yes, there's a lot of tradition in boxing, what we have to do now is start using the technology we've got at our disposal to kind of tell those stories and take people on those journeys with us through a medium that they know how. I mean, we always have these fights at Empress Palace. So it's not only about creating like an online platform. We're also looking at, you know, a far more immersive live experience, you know, so better production, better visuals, like the music, the walk-ins, the storytelling in the venues itself. So it's not really about like alienating a specific, you know, partner or tradition or doing away with the tradition. Boxing at its core will always remain that. It's about how can we just take it to another level that's more consumable.
Can you ensure that the new revenue streams that you're talking about actually benefit the fighters directly instead of accelerating the trend of talent leaving for overseas promoters? That is a risk.
Yeah, that's a big risk. And that's something that we've really taken into account. So as a boxing promoter, what we really focus on is building the profiles athletes. And in saying that, when you build someone's profile, you often find you run the risk of them leaving for overseas. But I think boxing in South Africa, there is money. It's a multi-million rand industry as it is at the moment. If you add up the live gates, the broadcast, the sponsorship and related spend, right? But if you compare to the passion it generates, I feel it's still under-monetized. So there's a lot more we can do with that. And I think if we step into that digital aspect, it lets us grow that pie. By one, reaching fans far beyond, the in-person and beyond our borders, and also creating that direct-to-consumer products like the streaming and the pay-per-view. What that helps us do is package better rights and richer data for our sponsors and our partners, because sponsorship and partnership is key to making this work, and it's a key revenue stream for us. So, if we can package better rights, we can increase the commercial value of every event, and ultimately that allows that value to flow back to the athletes. So it's full circle. So basically, the more money we have, the more we can increase our fighters' purse. It's a high-risk sport, high reward. We can't have high risk with low reward. So definitely it will flow back to athletes, but we have to start from the beginning. It's a full circle.
You used, Navi, the phrase earlier, adapt or die. You are effectively turning a legacy promoter into a digital business. I'm just wondering if there is operational or if there is cultural resistance that you are encountering behind the scenes, or is this a smooth passage so far?
Nothing in business is ever smooth, Jeremy. You will have a little bit resistance, and that going into this, I was very cognizant of that, because you'll always have people say, but this is how we've always been doing it. And I just have to navigate around that sometimes. But the more I show people, and the more I make it visually appealing for them, so I can prove to them this is what we do, then they come onto that journey a lot easier. So it's not going in and saying we're doing A, B, and C and we're doing it now. It's showing them the impact that A, B, and C has, and that's a little bit of a smoother transition. I know Golden Gloves is, 48 years old. I need to make it sustainable for another 48 years or 50 years or even longer, and that in itself is seems like a daunting task. But if I look at the tools and the tech that we have, I don't think it's undoable. Also, I wouldn't have embarked on this journey. I definitely think we can make something amazing just stepping into the digital realm of things.
And the digital realm often promises, Navi, more transparency. So is this going to make things like governance and purses and contracts a little bit more open? Often that side of the sport, that side of the business, is a little bit clouded and murky.
Yeah, it will, because everything is digitized. Even in terms of for our partners, those things are important, right? We're working towards the first part of the digital transformation part was having that backbone for boxing, putting the live streaming and that. And on top of that, we have to look at the data more intelligently, understand who's watching from where and which platforms. And as we build that out, the price and packaging events becomes, even better. And we give our partners real measurable value. Putting contracts and all of that on the digital platform, partnering with Boxing South Africa, vetting our contracts and things like that is what we're currently doing now. So there is transparency, there is visibility on it. And if there's a possibility or an avenue for us to explore getting more visibility and more transparency, we'll take it. We'll do it.
I'll just need a quick answer as we come to the end of this. What will the measurement of success be like in the short to medium term?
I think for me, if I could just make, boxing more modern, more sustainable, and more inclusive, that would be great for me. Modern in the sense of, having that strong digital foundation and that global reach. I think global reach for me is a big one. I want more people looking into South Africa and Africa instead of us always looking overseas for the big boxing fights. Sustainable in the sense that our fighters can build real careers here in Africa without having to leave, so that they can in turn build their own brands, get their own sponsors, instead of just looking for a purse or one night purse fight, you know, and inclusive in seeing that more women in leadership and more women get involved in the sport. And it's no longer unusual for us to be there. It's just normal, you know, and I don't mean like inclusive in that we have to be be on every board or sit at every directorship, but even inclusive in thought, where we're sharing our thoughts and our opinions. So I think if, you know, we get that going, I would have felt like I would have done my job.
Nivi Grogor, thank you very much indeed and good luck. And that's where we are going to leave it for today. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.